Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new study from the Institute for New Economic Thinking that is a front-page story in Monday's New York Times. The middle class is steadily eroding. Just ask the business world. Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who was formerly chief economist at the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and Budget Committee, joins us to discuss stark evidence that our economy is becoming a plutonomy, with the top 5% of earners accounting for almost 40% of personal consumption spending in 2012, up from 27% in 1992. Then we'll examine the drug overdose death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, apparently from heroin laced with fentanyl. Jeff Deeney, a social worker and writer based in Philadelphia, joins us. He has an article at The Atlantic, Hoffman and the Terrible Heroin Deaths in the Shadows, and we will discuss the growing epidemic of overdose deaths, batches of fentanyl-tainted heroin across the Mid-Atlantic, and the increased infection rates amongst injecting drug users of drug-resistant bacterial infections. Then finally, with a 2012 Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration study finding that between 2007 and 2012, the number of heroin users aged 12 and up increased from 373,000 to 669,000, and with heroin now cheaper than it's ever been for decades, we will look into how the war on drugs is going on the heroin front. A leading analyst on drug abuse and crime control policies, Mark Kleiman, a professor of public policy at the UCLA School of Public Affairs and author of Drugs and Drug Policies, joins us to discuss the increased abuse of prescription drugs like OxyContin, along with street heroin that is now laced with the powerful and unpredictable fentanyl that can be manufactured locally in illicit pharmacies.
She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. From out on the island, in the back room she was everybody's darling, but she never lost her head, even when she was given head. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go doo 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 doo. Little Joe never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side.
Joining us now is Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a senior fellow and director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was managing director at Soros Fund Management and chief economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here.
And your institute was behind a report that just came out that was featured in on a front page story in Monday's New York Times, The Middle Class is Steadily Eroding, Just Ask the Business World. And I must say it's a very disturbing trend and not totally surprising, but it looks as if in the business world, where we know that big chain stores like Sears and JCPenney are in trouble. We've learned, of course, that on the other end, Barney's is now taking over from Lohmann's, which is going bankrupt, etc. So do we have a plutonomy now instead of an economy?
Well, it's what Willie Sutton used to say. Why do you rob a bank? Well, that's where the money is. And I think for our society, it's somewhat unfortunate. But the very high concentrations of income and wealth, particularly in the aftermath of the crisis of 2008, have led to a concentration of earning power and spending power in a very small segment of the population. It's serving places like New York and San Francisco and catering to the tastes of what you might call luxury goods, luxury automobiles, luxury clothing, luxury restaurants, and that standard middle class baseline that Sears or JCPenney represented is part of what's being hollowed out.
I have always understood that the U.S. economy is something like 70% driven by consumer spending. And you may recall, Robert Johnson, that after 9/11, the first thing that President George W. Bush said was tell everybody to go to the mall. So it sounds like if only the rich are buying, the economy is not sustainable.
Well, I think there's real serious questions there. The wealthy people, as you know, have a much higher amount of savings. And so they can shut off or turn on their consumption rather capriciously, whereas the middle class is much more, purchasing staples, things they need for their livelihood, food and basic clothing and so forth. So it's a much more dependable form of demand, whereas for the wealthy, it's like I said, switch it on, switch it off. It's luxury. And that makes for a much bumpier road for the overall macro economy. Unless business investment steps up and is very resilient and strong. And in the aftermath of 2008, business investment has been very cautious and very reluctant. Lots of big corporations are hoarding cash.
So the new study that your Institute for New Economic Thinking funded, specifically done by the economist Stephen Fazari of the Washington University in St. Louis and Barry Sineman, of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, finds that the top 5% of earners accounted for almost 40% of personal consumption expenditures in 2012, up from 27% in 1992. Now, I recall a few years ago there was a leaked memo from Citigroup by one of its analysts that talked about the idea that we could get by with the plutonomy, with only the rich purchasing. And at the time, it was greeted with a lot of alarm, but it's looking more and more like it's actually coming into play.
Well, I would say there are two dimensions of alarm. One is the nature of a society where people's access to, which you might call influence in politics or lifestyle, is so markedly different that they almost cease to be members of the same society. The other dimension, which Sineman and Fazari talk about, is the resilience of the economy. The economy itself becomes much more volatile, much more turbulent, much more unstable when you concentrate wealth, as has happened in this country. I think both are sources of concern, but the problem in an economy where there is a very broad population that's not even in the middle class is they tend to experience lots of credit rationing, and in recessions, they shut off their consumption much more violently because they essentially have to hoard cash for fear of being laid off. And it makes the downturns much steeper and the upturns much more delayed and fragile. And I think the American economy is suffering from these kind of problems based on this analysis.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, who's the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. And you just mentioned one of the authors of this new study that your institute financed, Mr. Fazari. He said that it's going to be hard to maintain strong economic growth with such a large proportion of the population falling behind. And I recall a talk that was once given that I was hosting at the UCLA Hammer Forum with he's called a patriotic billionaire. he was saying, Nick Hanauer, he did a TED talk that got a lot of attention, and he was basically making the point. He said, look, I'm a rich guy, but I can only go out to a fancy restaurant every now and then. Frankly, I don't like it. I can only buy one or two or three cars for my family. I can't buy 300 cars. And that's always stuck with me, and particularly now when you learn that across the country, the Olive Gardens and the Red Lobster restaurants are having trouble, whereas the Capitol Grill is at the high end, is flourishing. Barney's is doing incredibly well. Lohmann's is going out of business. And as we mentioned earlier, the Sears and JCPenney are really in trouble. So address that, if you will.
Well, I think this is a reflection of the structure, this pattern of distribution of wealth. I think that the patriotic millionaire was right in that there's just only so much you can eat. There's only so much you can do. The Capitol Grill, I understand, has an average bill of about $71. Olive Garden's at about $15. Similarly, we're seeing things like JCPenney's going down, Sears going down, but Dollar Store, way at the bottom, the Dollar Store is doing better. At the same time as Barney's and other luxury chains are doing better. And this is a reflection of that hollowing out of the middle class, like the New York Times talks about in their article today.
Yeah, and of course, at the other end of the food chain, if you will, McDonald's is doing well too. So it further reinforces that point. But isn't maybe this is mythology that we're a middle class country? I mean, it always made sense. Henry Ford once say that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product?
Yes, and in a national closed economy, at some level, that's true. And part of what's happened in the United States is our leaders, like Henry Ford, like the Rockefeller family and others after the Second World War, invested in the deepening and a broadening of the middle class. It became an ethic for society. In more modern times, what Samuel P. Huntington called Davos Man now has his plants all over the world, and he doesn't need an educated American workforce. He doesn't need a healthy American workforce, and he may not even need American demand because the middle class is rising in parts of Asia and parts of Latin America, as well as continuing in Europe. So the Davos Man, as a social leader, is making a lot of money putting his plants in places where environmental conditions and labor working rights have been diminished and where his profit margins are thereby enhanced. And it's a very, very different structure of society, the one that Henry Ford talked about.
Well, interesting enough, though, Robert Johnson, on the eve of the most recent Davos meeting in Switzerland, Oxfam came out with a report that finds that only 85 individuals on this planet have the combined wealth equal to that of half of the world's population of 3.5 billion human beings. I mean, if that doesn't tell us that inequality has taken over, I don't know what does.
Well, that's I remember that Davos result, and that's quite startling. It is interesting to me that the rapid increase in inequality in the United States has actually been going on since about 1978, and it was not until the Occupy Wall Street movement took hold with their slogan, "We are the 99%, meaning they are the 1%, which I think was coined from a Joe Stiglitz article in Vanity Fair, because he talked about for a buy-in of the 1%, and that's where they picked up their slogan. But that notion of the 1% has been growing for 30 years, and now all of a sudden it's startling. And what's really daunting is the political economy of reducing the influence of wealth when wealth is so concentrated. It's very, very difficult. It's very hard to get congressmen and senators to vote, to make themselves more responsive to voters and less responsive to those plutocrats that inhabit the 1%.
And largely finance our elections, right?
And almost dominate the financing of elections, according to work like my colleague at the Roosevelt Institute, Thomas Ferguson. This is a very, very narrowly constructed, despite the conversations about all of the retail website. It's the unrestricted money, the big post-Citizens United money that dominates who gets nominated, who gets elected and what kind of legislation and policy proposals are undertaken. And they're often policy proposals quite contrary to public opinion polls as evidence of the wishes of majority of Americans.
Well, it would seem that one of the indicators of the new reality was it came out during the election campaign when Mitt Romney was caught on tape talking about the 47%, which I believe a lot of wealthy plutocrats, and I think he's a sort of minor plutocrat, Romney, or an aspiring plutocrat, I guess, not quite a billionaire, but that I believe is really the sort of the accidental truth of where we're at, isn't it? Where the powerful and the rich and the corporate power basically own the government, and they don't really want it to work for anybody else because it's working so well for them. And they've been able to convince an awful lot of people that government doesn't work. And the reason government doesn't work is it's not working for most of us.
Yeah, it's become unrepresentative. An engineer always looks for what he calls a feedback mechanism. When things get out of balance, the feedback mechanism sends a signal and the system corrects itself. And our feedback mechanisms are broken. They're anesthetized by very large concentrated amounts of money. Now, I don't want to be too dark on this in the sense that I know a number of people who are quite wealthy, well within the 1%, who are actually very well-meaning people in trying to inspire constructive change. So I don't think it is as good a system as we would have if representation and responsiveness of politics was much more broad-based. But not all the wealthy people in our country are trying to just put the hammer to the rest of us.
Well, that's true, and Warren Buffett once warned that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. But these statistics that your institute have studied, that your institute financed, that have now appeared on the front pages of Monday's New York Times, which are pretty alarming, and which is why we're having this conversation. This is a part of something that's out there in the zeitgeist. You mentioned the Occupy movement.
Yes.
So where do we move from now, given that we're heading into a new kind of feudalism? Many have said this is the new Gilded Age. First of all, it would seem that if you use the analogy of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing you have to do is admit that you're an addict. And in this case, admit that we're all victims of a class war that we've lost. So is that the starting point?
Well, in large concept, there is the notion of $1, one vote, which approximates the condition we have. And there's the notion of one person, one vote, which means the democratic currency is stronger. And I do think we're in a period not unlike the very beginning of the 20th century when McClure's magazine started to publish the works of Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens and others that became muckrakers, and the great movement for social change began first, under Teddy Roosevelt, and then eventually we moved to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal following the Depression, and the pendulum swung in favor of a much more progressive and egalitarian structure of society. I think we're hopefully near the starting gates of that, where, like you say, we diagnosed the problem, and now people have to exercise their democratic currency, meaning their votes, their participation, their activism on a much broader scale, because their municipal pensions, the quality of their school systems, everything is under threat right now. And it's a very important time for Americans to, what you might call, contribute to the kind of country they'd like their children to have.
Well, of course, the difference is, though, that in the days of Ida Tarbell and Mark Twain and the muckrakers, these tended to be smaller independent publications, albeit with a lot of readership. They didn't have to compete with television and radio. But nowadays, we have this juggernaut called corporate media, and we have open sort of, you know, propaganda operations like Fox News, and it's equivalent on the left, MSNBC. So we don't have much traction in terms of First of all, we don't have any Ida Tarbells, as far as I know, or Mark Twain's. I wish we did. I'm not sure they'd get printed today, would they?
Yeah, well, I guess that big capital-intensive concentrated media, particularly the television, I think you're right about. But we do have something called the Internet that didn't exist in those days. Mm-hmm. And there may be people, you know, whether it's Cornel West or Paul Street or Naomi Klein, there are lots of very interesting people who are shedding light on many of these dimensions and unhealthy or oppressive dimensions of our society. And the question is, what do we do when we know this? What do we do when we learn these things? How do we exercise the power of community to rebalance society? So, yes, I think you're not going to see an ad for Buy Nothing Day and Adbusters at the Super Bowl. They're not going to put that on. But the Internet is full, as the people at Adbusters have shown us with their websites and their pamphlets on changing economics and so forth, that there's a great deal of potential for people to connect and communicate and propagate things through social networking.
Well, Robert Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committees. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about how the war on drugs is doing on the heroin front.
The rich get richer, the poor are getting poorer. Fascist, chauvinistic government fool.
People and Muslims, Christians and Hindus are in the times also searching for the truth. Who are you to think of a superior race? Racing for your everlasting doom.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Deeney, who's a social worker and writer based in Philadelphia. His work has appeared in The Atlantic and Newsweek, and he's a columnist at The Fix, a website dedicated to addiction and recovery. He has an article at The Atlantic, Hoffman and the Terrible Heroin Deaths in the Shadows. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Deeney.
Thank you for inviting me, Ian.
And you yourself are a recovering addict. You've been clean now for how long? 10 years?
It was 10 years. Yeah, absolutely. On January 20th, just passed.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman was apparently clean for 23 years. Is that that's the report that I've read?
That is what I understand. Yeah, that he had more than 2 decades clean and sober before relapsing.
And he was a family man with young kids. Do you have any idea of what happened there? Or is it just one of those?
I think that it's not terribly common, but it's also not unheard of for people with very long periods of sobriety to relapse. I mean, I don't think that any recovering addict is immune to the potential for relapse. That's part of the reason why recovering addicts stay plugged into communities of other recovering addicts where they can get ongoing support for their drug-related issues, particularly as you get older. There's questions of, you know, will I need to have pain medication for a surgical procedure, for instance? You know, what if I need to have a massive dental operation, something like that, where you're going to have to take narcotic medication of some kind? Those are the sort of things that if you're plugged into, you know, recovery communities, you can get direction in terms of how to navigate something like that, which is very tricky without it potentially triggering a relapse. And so that's what I've seen in the time that I've been in recovery, people that have had long-term sobriety that have relapsed and started using again. A lot of times it's hooked to a medical procedure or something like that.
Well, in this case, apparently, as much as we know, that Philip Seymour Hoffman died from an overdose of heroin laced with fentanyl. Is that your understanding?
I think right now the fentanyl angle is still unresolved. I don't know if the toxicology has come back yet. The fentanyl tainted heroin thing is a major problem. I mean, I'll say that as somebody who works still in North Philadelphia communities where heroin trades and is used, the fentanyl thing is a bigger problem now than it's ever been in the past. It's popped up a couple times previously, but right now it's popping up more frequently and across more broader areas of geography where, you know, for instance, over the past, you know, 8 months or so, you know, first there was a batch in Camden, New Jersey, and then it jumped across the river to Philly, and then it went further west to central Pennsylvania, you know, Lebanon, PA, and now, you know, out to Pittsburgh. They're finding it down in Baltimore. So these bags that are fentanyl, which is a very, very potent narcotic painkiller mixed with heroin, are popping up more frequently, and they are very dangerous because it's very easy to overdose if you're injecting them.
And my understanding is that fentanyl is very powerful and somewhat unpredictable, and mm-hmm. and it's also can be manufactured in locally in illicit pharmacies.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I've been watching this for a long time, and the thing that struck me this last bout of overdoses that came out of Pittsburgh, where, I mean, you can see how in about an eight-month period, it just walked across the state of Pennsylvania in a straight line. It was like people dying in Camden, people dying in Philadelphia, all the way up to western Pennsylvania. So I don't know. I mean, I can only speculate about what that might be, but I don't know. I had thought that it's possible that maybe there's one person who manufactures this fentanyl who, you know, puts it out on the streets, and when things start to get hot and there's attention from law enforcement, maybe is able to just pick up shop and move on to the next town. I don't know. I mean, I think that law enforcement, I think, is pretty uncertain at this point exactly how this stuff keeps getting into the stream of black market narcotics.
Well, of course, the tragedy, as you point out in your article at The Atlantic, Jeff Deeney, Hoffman, and the terrible heroin deaths in the shadows, is that there is a product, a very easily accessible. It's often called Narcan. Its name is Naxalone.
Naltrexone. It's an overdose reversing medication. It sort of like strips the opiate from the receptor in the brain, so that somebody who is even very close to the verge of death, if you give them it's coming in a nasal spray now, where you can just spray it in somebody's nostril, and they're revived immediately. Like they spring back from that, and it's a really amazing medication. And there is a push amongst advocates for that to be available over the counter. I mean, it has no abuse potential. It's really non-toxic. I mean, there's really no reason it shouldn't be more widely available, not just to addicts on the street who might be injecting heroin, but people who have pain medication in their house. If you have small children or if you have elderly people in the home who might be able to access that, it seems to me from a poison control perspective, it would be smart to have the antidote around to a toxic dose of that medication.
So, Jeff Deeney is a social worker and writer based in Philadelphia. His work has appeared in The Atlantic and Newsweek, and he's a columnist at The Fix, a website dedicated to addiction and recovery. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Hoffman and the Terrible Heroin Deaths in the Shadows. Now, in terms of naloxone, or Narcan, as it's also called, if it were readily available in Philip Seymour Hoffman's case, he was injecting alone. So obviously, if you overdose on a powerful dose that's perhaps laced with fentanyl, then you're not the person to recover, because your lights go out pretty quickly, right? You need a partner, don't you?
That- That is what I do understand in terms of the fentanyl bags. Yeah, that it hits you pretty quick and pretty hard. And what I think you might even start to see is that the thing with the fentanyl bags is that they go really fast. Once they hit the market, they disappear really quickly because users seek them out when they hear that people are dying because they bought, you know, the Ace of Spades bag or whatever it is branded as. That, you know, addicts with substantial habits are going to think that this is something that, you know, if it's strong enough to kill new users, that this is definitely going to be something I want to get my hands on because it'll be able to hold me in my addiction. And I think that maybe that might start to pass because I've talked to users who say they don't really like the fentanyl bags too much. Like, it's a different feeling. It's more of a very heavy, you know, physical kind of experience as opposed to the sort of lightheaded euphoria that comes along with heroin, that, like, it hits you fast and it just nails you to the couch kind of thing. And a lot of users don't like it. I mean, that is what I've heard, yeah.
But you also said that a lot of heavy users like it strong. So when the reputation comes out that you've got some really heavy stuff on the street, rather than run away from it, people are attracted to it. Is that what you told
right.
us?
Yeah, I mean, if you know there's a – basically, yeah, I mean, you know a bag is strong. If a bunch of – you know, if 14 people died off of the same bag the day before, I mean, you know that it's definitely potent. And yeah, absolutely, users are attracted to that. And, you know, risk of overdose is part of being an injecting drug user. I think that's, you know, that's part of the deal if you're an addict. That comes along with the territory. And, you know, people who have substantial habits really feel like, you know, they can handle it because they're experienced users. They know what kind of dosage they need. And I think what you see with Philip Seymour Hoffman is also the fact that he was going in and out of rehab towards the end of his life. And that is the time when you are more likely as a user to overdose. Like, if you were recently detoxed off of the drug and your tolerance for the drug resets, and you were not taking that into account and you just go back out on the street and buy the same amount of drugs that you're used to doing before you got detoxed, that's a way that you can very easily overdose. And we see that here in Philadelphia a lot with people getting out of jail and going right back to the corners where they used to buy at and doing the amount they used to do and overdosing and dying not far from the corner where they bought.
So in terms of the work that you do, Jeff Deeney, as a columnist for The Fix, which is a website dedicated to addiction and recovery, I'm sure a lot of people listening to our interview will basically say, well, you know, if people want to do that to themselves, you know, they're welcome to, but why should we care?
Sure. And I would, you know, argue that, you know, you should care, first of all, because the cost is really, really expensive in terms of dollars, if you want to look at it from that perspective. You know, when drug users wind up in prison, you know, it costs the state a tremendous amount of money. When drug users contract chronic diseases like hepatitis C or HIV, those things cost tremendous amounts of money. If somebody is getting drug treatment who is poor and doesn't have private health coverage, those kinds of things costs a lot of money. So, in terms of having smart approaches to our drug policies, there's definitely a cost perspective as well in terms of, you know, look, if you can give people clean syringes are very cheap. And if you don't get hung up on, you know, a moral question about whether, are you facilitating somebody's use or enabling them to use if you're giving them clean syringes, but prevent most of those people from contracting HIV or hepatitis C, a drug or a disease that will cost society tremendous amounts of money to treat, you know, there's a financial incentive on top of just sort of like the basic humanity of wanting to make sure that everybody has access to quality care for whatever disorder that they have. And, you know, we are trying more and more to see addiction as a health issue as opposed to a criminal justice issue.
But you have to add to that, surely, Jeff Deeney, that there are drug-resistant bacteria that are also being infection rates are going up amongst injecting drug users.
Right. And, you know, this is something that I did write about this for The Fix last year. And this is something I think that is not reported on enough. I think that this is going to be a very, very big deal in the next 10 to 20 years of drug addiction. You know, what you see right now is an uptick. It's not an epidemic per se yet, but you definitely see a higher frequency of needle using drug users in the community who are contracting MRSA and other kinds of antibiotic resistant infections. So, and the consequences of those are really, really horrifying. I mean, I have spoken to families of drug addicts who have contracted MRSA and other kinds of resistant bacterial infections on the street, and it's really horrifying in terms of both the medical care that's required is incredibly invasive, multiple surgeries, talking about people having large parts of their body removed in order to trap the infection and get rid of it. So you're talking about people that are winding up profoundly disabled, you know, permanent disability, and the impact that has, again, in terms of the costs from, you know, a health care system perspective, and then also just in terms of the humanity of somebody having to experience that when it might not be necessary. I think that is going to be a really, really big issue in years to come as resistant bacteria become more common.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Deeney, who's a social worker and writer based in Philadelphia. His work has appeared in The Atlantic and Newsweek, and he's a columnist at The Fix, a website dedicated to addiction and recovery. He has an article at The Atlantic, Hoffman and the Terrible Heroin Deaths in the Shadows. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back examining the drug overdose death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Gonna try for the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike into my vein. And I tell you things aren't quite the same when I'm rushing on my run, and I feel just like Jesus' son.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Kleiman, who's a professor of public policy at UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches a course on methods of policy analysis and on drug abuse and crime control policy. He's the author of Marijuana Costs of Abuse, Costs of Control, Against Excess Drug Policy for Results, When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and Drugs and Drug Policy, and Marijuana Legalization. He edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin, and he also worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Kleiman.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be on.
And the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman seems to have brought back an awareness, at least in the press, of a heroin addiction that's loose in the land. Some headlines are saying heroin use is up 79%. What do your statistics tell you?
I don't know where the 79% number comes from. You'd have to say up from when and among whom. You'd have to say whether you're talking about the number of users, the number of addicts, the volume consumed, all different numbers. What's been happening, and this is a long process, price of heroin has been falling steadily for 30 years now, and is now at something like a tenth of the level it was when I first got interested in this topic. So one thing that's happened is that heroin on the street has gotten purer. That means that people are consuming more just on a daily basis. It also means that it's now economically possible to snort it rather than injecting it. And so the needle barrier is lower than it was for heroin. Other thing that's been happening is that the explosion in the non-medical use of prescription opiate painkillers, particularly hydrocodone and oxycodone, which seems to have started around 1994, 95. Initiation to those drugs is up almost tenfold over that period. And so we've now got about as many people starting those every year as start cannabis every year. Those are substitutes for heroin, but they're more expensive.
And
so one of the dynamics that's happening is that people are getting, so are starting on the pills, which seems safer. You're not, you know, buying them from a grubby street dealer, and you're getting a pill in a pharmaceutical bottle that you don't have to inject. But when people get strung out, they may trade down to the cheaper heroin because the heroin costs about a quarter as much on a per milligram basis. Or they may switch from swallowing to either snorting or injecting, which both of which are easier with powdered heroin than with a pill. So that's the pattern I'm seeing. And heroin's still not very large on the radar screen, but it's clearly what's coming up as cocaine is going down.
And what is this? Apparently, Philip Fimo Hoffman was found with 50 bags of heroin. Some was heroin. A lot of it was brand named Ace of Spades, Ace of Hearts. But apparently, according to preliminary reports, some of it was laced with fentanyl. And apparently that is the new high, at least in that part of New York where he was found dead.
Fentanyl has always looked as if it might be the heroin replacement. It's a synthetic, relatively easy to produce, doesn't have to be imported. The problem with fentanyl that's kept it from ever getting much of a market up till now is dosage control, because you're dealing with very, very small amounts. The risk of overdose is greater. And I haven't seen the toxicology reports on Hoffman, so I'm not sure what he actually died of. I don't know whether he had fentanyl on board. But that's what's been keeping fentanyl from taking off. Now, if you say that it has finally taken off in New York, I'm not very surprised. But its presence on the street has been there. It's been there for a while and has, at least so far, yet to gain much market share.
But when you say it's easier to produce and it can be done here in the United States, you're talking about illegal production?
Yeah. It's not a bathtub chemical the way methamphetamine is. It's complicated chemistry. But you don't need a field full of poppies. You need a chem lab.
I see. But it's very potent and therefore difficult to regulate the amounts. And apparently, at least the reports that are coming in now seem to indicate that fentanyl was in the dose that Hoffman...
There's a specific chemical called fentanyl, and then there's a whole class of fentanyls, some of which are extraordinarily potent, some down to the microgram level. So I'd want to see what the actual doc said. Fentanyl's somewhat more potent than heroin. But some of the related chemicals are hundreds of times as potent.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Kleiman, who's a professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches courses on methods of policy analysis on drug abuse and crime control policy, and is the author of a number of books, including When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and Drugs and Drug Policy and Marijuana Legalization. He edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin and has also worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. So when drug uses go up and down, and you've discussed how some are going up and some are going down and some are getting cheaper and some are getting more expensive, what drives these fads? I mean, is it like fashion? Is there any explanation for that?
If I knew what drove fashion, I'd be designing women's clothing rather than doing policy analysis.
Right.
The basic mechanism was laid out by David Musto in a book called The American Disease about 40 years ago. A new drug comes on the market, new to some particular user group. Somebody likes it, enjoys it, says to his friends, hey, I've found this wonderful thing. They try it, they enjoy it, they say to their friends, hey, we've got this wonderful thing. And it's fashionable. It's the cutting edge thing to do. Doing it shows you're sophisticated and wealthy. And it snowballs. And so you get literally exponential growth. That is to say, growth that's proportional to the size of the current user group. That goes on for a while. and then two things happen. The pool of susceptibles is depleted. Eventually, everybody who wants to try it has already tried it. And some of the people who tried it and liked it a while ago have now been using it for a while and suddenly aren't enjoying it. They've developed substance abuse disorder. So a new heroin user may very well recruit another new heroin user. Somebody who's been addicted to heroin for 5 years and recruit anybody. He's a standing bad advertisement. And so, and frequently the price falls and the social status falls. And so in 1977, the typical cocaine user was a hedge fund manager and in the public mind. And by 10 years later, the typical cocaine user was a $5 prostitute. Well, oddly enough, I'm not sure it represented sound moral judgment. A lot of people prefer to think of themselves as hedge fund managers. And so as the social status of the drug fell, it got to be less popular among the people who want to be fashionable. So that's the standard epidemic cycle. We're now on the downslope of the cocaine epidemic. We've been on the downslope of the 1960s heroin epidemic ever since. And whether this is the beginning of an uptick or not, ask me 2 years from now.
What I find extraordinary about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death, and obviously we don't know anything about his mental state, but he did have a young family, a son and two daughters, and I'm wondering, what is it about this drug that would make you, in effect, so selfish that you would not think about those that you're leaving behind? Is it that seductive?
Well, not clear to me what he did, right? If he simply got a bad batch, he may not have thought he was doing anything remarkably selfish. I don't know what his level of problem was, though if he had 50 bags, that sounds like he was using pretty steadily. You know, if he died in a drunk driving crash, would he have asked the same question? People get into bad drug habits. That's one of the characteristic risks of using drugs. And it's not less true for alcohol than it is for other drugs.
Well, certainly one's not blaming the victim here. And I was just trying to get into the general and broader question, which I know you've dealt with and a lot of people on drug policy have dealt with, which is we only deal with the after results. We don't deal with the psychological reasons. We never ask the question of why people use drugs, do we?
Oh, no, that's a well-discussed question.
Right.
But here the question is not why he was using, but why his use got out of control to the point where he put his life at risk. Most users of most drugs aren't abusers. The celebrity heroin users who aren't dying today, we haven't heard about. And heroin has what's called a low therapeutic index. That is to say, the ratio between the effective dose and the lethal dose is much smaller than would make a safe drug. And so heroin overdose is a constant risk. There is a public health approach that's been discussed, which is making naloxone, which is an antagonist, widely available. That probably would not have helped in this case. The description I saw was that he'd actually died with a needle in his arm, which suggests it was really anaphylactic shock rather than literal overdose. But again, I haven't seen the postmortem.
So this drug that you mentioned, I understand it was called Narcan, which...
Yeah, it's Narcan. It's a drug that competes for the receptor site right. And doesn't actually do anything. And so people can take it as a way of preventing themselves from using heroin or other opiates, because if you take it and then use heroin, nothing happens. But it can also be used to reverse an acute overdose.
And fire departments have it, and it's commonly brought people back that they found in an overdose situation.
Yes.
But the problem would be then if you're a lone heroin user, as apparently Philip Seymour Hoffman was.
Not going to help.
It can't help.
The other discussion is having it so that it's not just EMTs who have it.
Right. Well,
that the people who are around when somebody's using have it.
Right. Well, that doesn't sound like a bad idea. What's the resistance to that?
Oh, resistance to anything that reduces drug-related harm. Somebody says, well, it'll encourage drug use. The current administration has been supportive, and it's moving as a policy issue now.
Because I recall Mark Kleiman, somewhat slightly different situation, but apparently very much the same drug. You know, the KGB developed a gas, an aerosolite heroin, that was used against the Chechens who took over a theater in Moscow. And that was an operation that was conducted entirely and micromanaged by Vladimir Putin. And they didn't bother to give all of those innocent Russians who were in the theater, who all got gassed along with the Chechen terrorists. Narcan, and they all died. I mean, it was one of the many scandals that's associated with that incident. So, you know, the idea that something exists that could bring people back from the dead and not used is always, I found, very troubling.
So they were using an opiate aerosolized? I hadn't known that.
Yeah, yeah, that's how they got everybody unconscious, and then they went through.
What were they using, do you know?
Obviously some classified KGB developed drug, but at the time I looked into it, and particularly the fact that Putin himself micromanaged the case and didn't give a damn about the average citizens, just wanted to kill the terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I find troubling, and that these people were just essentially died unnecessarily as collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, the point being that there is something that's available. So it's only available then, this Narcan's only available for what, fire, paramedics?
No, it varies from state to state. So some states are making it available.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, it's not a controlled substance.
I see. So,
I mean, Narcan has no psychoactivity of its own.
Right. So... So why is it not available then, if it's not a controlled substance?
It's a prescription drug, so you need laws that allow the distribution of it.
I see. And you say that we're slowly making progress. At least the White House is on the side of making it more available.
Yes, this is not something I've followed closely, but yes, that's something that's moving.
So in terms of where the stuff comes from, going back to street heroin. I guess a lot of it comes from Mexico, but we keep hearing reports about Afghanistan now that we're getting out of after America's longest war, that opium production is at the highest level ever. Is that stuff that you've been following that?
Well, sure. Afghanistan produces all of the opium for the old world. Some of it has gotten into the West Coast, but we're still overwhelmingly dominated by Mexican heroin.
And when you say the old world, that's Europe and Russia?
Yeah, Asia and Europe and Africa all get their opiates from Afghan poppy.
Right. And what about interdiction? I mean, what about buying up the crop? Nothing's ever been able to be accomplished there?
Well, I mean, the problem is that there's not a crop, right? And poppies are easy to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we buy the crop, then the poppy farmers will grow two crops, one for us and one for the dealers.
I see.
I mean, it's been done. It doesn't work. It's your basic economics tells you it won't work.
Well, but there's a certain irony, surely, Mark, where we have fighting a war in Afghanistan. We have it's our longest war. We've been in there for 12 years. And we're also fighting a war on drugs, and somehow...
Well, and we've quite successfully pushed poppy production out of the government-controlled parts of Afghanistan, right? Because we're fighting the war on drugs. What that means is that we've given the Taliban a monopoly on opium for the old world. Right, 27 of the 34 provinces of Afghanistan are poppy-free. The other 7 are the ones the bad guys control. So this is a case where the drug war and the war on terror don't go together very well.
So is there then, in the broader sense, an answer here to this ubiquitous drug that is now coming back into popularity? Obviously, interdiction hasn't worked. What are the alternatives?
Well, no. Compared to what? Compared to what? I mean, compared to selling heroin over the counter, I think we have a lot less heroin addiction than we otherwise would have.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an enforcement strategy that substantially reduces heroin? Probably not. At the moment, the biggest advantage we have on the prevention side is the word heroin. A lot of people don't have a problem thinking of themselves as oxycodone users, but really don't want to think of themselves as heroin users. And what you worry about is over time people forget. So, you know, this case may help serve the prevention function.
Well,
there's no consolation to Mr. Hoffman's family.
Well, just in closing then, Mark Lyman, I know we've discussed this before, but it comes back to this idea of, legalization, which is often put up as an alternative to the current drug policy. Of course, it creates a tremendous backlash, and it may well be a question of semantics. What What about the notion of medicalization of the problem? If you had, as they've done in some countries, medical outpatient facilities for addicts to go to where they get clean drugs administered under clinical conditions, is that a viable alternative?
It's a perfectly reasonable alternative in reasonably well-governed cities. I don't want to think about the security you'd need for your heroin distribution facility in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And it's for a very limited number of really socially problematic and pretty hopeless addicts. It's not what the addicts want. They want to use heroin at home with their friends. So the people who come into the program are the people who are really at the edge. And, you know, since they're very expensive people, even though it's an expensive program, it saves money. It's not a way to address the larger heroin problem. It's a way to reduce the harms associated with the most extreme forms of addiction. So I'm not opposed to it, but it's not a panacea.
So, in other words, when a celebrity dies, we care about it, but the fact that a bunch of hardcore addicts in Bedford-Stuyvesant shooting up amongst their friends, we don't care about it.
No, I didn't say it at all.
I didn't say anything
remotely resembling that.
Uh-huh. No, I didn't. That's my sense, not yours. But is that...
No, in fact, heroin has always been the most vigorously enforced against drug. Right? I mean, if we only cared about drug abuse among prosperous folks, we're entirely on the enforcement side about prescription drugs.
Right.
No, heroin is still the number one enforcement priority, you know, along with cocaine and meth, all of which now are basically, not fashionable drugs.
But we have more of it than ever. So where's,
well,
you know. Isn't that
no, we don't have more of it than ever. We certainly aren't at the level we were in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an increase over the last several years from a fairly low level.
Yeah, but you say it's cheaper than it's ever been, right?
Mm-hmm. It's cheaper than it's ever been, which suggests that the bulk level enforcement isn't working very well. That is to say that people who traffic drugs have become more efficient in their operations. Not surprising. I think there's probably not much we can do on the enforcement side to change things.
Well, Mark, I guess this is a depressing subject, and we're not ending on an optimistic note, and I guess there's no way to, right?
Well, look, the optimistic note is that most people aren't at risk of heroin because they never touch a drug called heroin, and we should hang on to that.
Well, Mark Kleiman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Kleiman, who's a professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches courses on methods of policy analysis and on drug abuse and crime control policy. And he is the author of When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and also Drugs and Drug Policy and Marijuana Legalization. He also edits the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis, and he's also worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Stan Mizrahi and Jose Benavides. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.